I think what this is a one-stop shop for coordination of permitting, which is extremely important.
The president creates a new group to coordinate Alaskan energy development. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state lawmakers move to limit surveillance.
We didn't want to see a situation where private organizations could set cameras and start monitoring people and detecting who's walking around on the street.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The future of how Alaskans will produce the energy we need for our homes and businesses is uncertain. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to developing Alaska's vast renewable energy resources to create a clean, local, and sustainable energy supply. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by REAP, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska.
President Obama today created a new interagency group to coordinate oil and gas development in Alaska. It pulls together top officials from agencies like the Energy Department and the Environmental Protection Agency and calls upon them to meet periodically to share information, get on the same page with permitting, and look to long-term planning. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The new group will be led by Interior Department Deputy Secretary David Hayes. His goal is to get the federal agencies on the same page.
First, we are going to facilitate orderly and efficient decision-making processes by making sure that agencies are working together as we evaluate permits and conduct rigorous environmental reviews for onshore and offshore energy development projects in Alaska.
President Obama first announced plans in the spring for an interagency coordination group on Alaskan development. It's an idea that Senator Mark Begich had pushed. On Tuesday, the White House released an executive order, making it official. Hayes says it gives the federal departments an organized way of working together.
This means communicating on schedules and progress on different pending decisions, sharing application process, project information, developing jointly scientific and environmental data that are needed for good decision making, pulling together cultural and traditional knowledge across our agencies that are relevant. It means making sure that we're working together as a federal family collectively to have the best information available to make the best decisions possible.
Other players at the table include deputy-level staff from the Departments of Commerce, Agriculture, Defense, and Homeland Security, and the Office of the Federal Coordinator for Gas Projects, Larry Persily. Persily says there's certainly no downside to working together.
Coordination is good. There's no doubt about that. And certainly that's what this office has been doing since it was set up. So I think we can bring that knowledge, that skill to the table. We've been living that for the past year and a half or so.
So who's not at the table is the state of Alaska. The executive order calls for the group to work with the state, local Alaskan communities, tribes, and other stakeholders. But Governor Sean Parnell released a statement expressing concern that his office isn't part of the actual working group. However, the state did just let die the program that gives it a voice with the feds. The Coastal Zone Management Program guaranteed Alaska input into federal actions on coastal development. Joe Balash with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources says this group is different.
What we're talking about here is, in this case, is an interagency work group that is actually charged with finding a way to get to yes, as opposed to imposing additional hurdles and restrictions on activities. And so it's offense versus defense, I guess, is probably the best way to, or easiest way to describe it.
Just how much the interagency coordination will change things in Alaskan oil and gas development is anyone's guess. But with the executive order, President Obama fulfills a request that's come in from the congressional delegation and oil and gas companies. They've complained that permits are given out too slowly. But David Hayes says this is not a one-stop shop for oil and gas companies to get the go-ahead on development.
I think what this is a one-stop shop for coordination of permitting, which is extremely important. This is, as I said before, this is not a new super permitting group. Each department will continue to be responsible for implementing its statutory obligations as Congress requires it to do. But we will have a one-stop shop for coordinating permitting of oil and gas in the Arctic, and this group will ensure that there is good coordination in that regard.
Environmentalists welcomed comments by Hayes that the coordination group won't be fast-tracking development permits. Andrew Hartzig is the Anchorage-based director of the Arctic Program at the Ocean Conservancy. He points out that the executive order calls for a safe and responsible approach to development.
In the end, federal agencies still need to do their homework, especially with respect to science and spill response, and ensure that they're making no regrets decisions about drilling in Arctic waters.
The Interior Department's David Hayes announced the new group Tuesday at a conference on oil and gas development in Washington. He took questions from the audience and other experts at the event, including Fran Ulmer, head of the Arctic Research Commission. She voiced concerns that responsible oil and gas development requires costly infrastructure and environmental investments. Ulmer used as an example the need for a new Coast Guard icebreaker, which is nowhere near becoming a reality.
It does take investment. At the very same time that Congress seems totally preoccupied with the debt. Not that that's not important, but there are counterbalancing interests. Could you comment, please?
Hayes admitted that some members of Congress have tried to punish the Obama administration departments with budget cuts for what they see as permit delays. He says that actually slows things down.
We're concerned about that. We're very concerned about that. The Arctic is a very good example of an area that could be affected in significant ways by budget implications.
That talk about the budget gets to the heart of the situation in Washington these days, which is in gridlock over spending. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
In Washington today, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, or CSIS, held a one-day conference on Arctic oil and gas development. CSIS is an international security think tank. David Pumphrey is the Deputy Director of Energy and National Security for CSIS. Senator Murkowski gave the opening speech this morning. Also on the panel was Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell, oil industry officials, environmental watchdogs, and Deputy Director of Interior David Hayes. Pumphrey says CSIS pulled the conference together in an effort to provide more information on the political debate about how quickly Arctic development should or should not happen.
We see the oil and petroleum and gas resources in Alaska as a major asset in the energy resource base, and would really like to understand better what the questions are and what the potential solutions are.
The first session of today's gathering dealt with development and infrastructure options in the Arctic and also market challenges. What did you hear from Lieutenant Governor Treadwell and the industry people on what those options and challenges are?
Well, I think the first challenge that we heard, especially from the industry, but also from the Lieutenant Governor, was the challenge of a very complicated regulatory process that has multiple federal agencies involved and state agencies as well, and trying to work through that process. So that regulatory challenge was in many ways the one that they held up. One of the big questions that has not yet been answered is this capability of response.
And what about representatives from the Coast Guard? What did they have to say in relation to this issue of having adequate response in case there is a spill or an accident?
We were fortunate to have a representative from the Coast Guard who had been a senior official involved in the Gulf oil spill. So he had sort of working knowledge of what it took in that case. And he was describing a situation that they would have to do more work to make sure that they can be ready. They acknowledge that their assets are not located directly in the Arctic region, so they would have to be bringing in assets from other parts of the country to deal with it. So I think that is actually one of the challenges.
Did you get a sense from either folks with the Coast Guard or industry people about how far off we're talking before development may be occurring there? What kind of a timeline? Did they discuss that at all?
The Coast Guard really didn't put a timeline around it, but they didn't in any way say that they thought that their capabilities would be a roadblock. We had the Deputy Secretary of the Interior, David Hayes, as a speaker who announced the issuance of that executive order. But that's clearly a process that is just beginning, but it is an effort to, at a very high level, bring together the different players so that there can be better understanding. He was clear that it is not a one-stop licensing function, but it's an effort for the U.S. government to be better coordinated in the actions it's taking and to be sharing information amongst different agencies that have a role in a much more efficient manner than if they maintain their activities separately.
And what about Deputy Secretary of Interior Hayes? Did he focus primarily on the executive order, or what other message did he bring in today's talk?
He opened his talk by reiterating that the president and therefore the rest of the administration is committed to moving forward with development of oil and gas resources in the United States, especially in Alaska, if it can be done in a responsible manner and making certain that you're minimizing the risks. So it opened with that type of a sort of policy statement, and then spent most of his time describing the executive order and how they are trying to pull the pieces together to make sure that they can do the evaluation before leases are issued or permits are issued to be certain that they are moving ahead responsibly.
Your gathering had environmental challenges discussed this afternoon, and the Arctic is a tough place, but the ecosystem is fragile there. What concerns were raised environmentally?
There were people from the environmental community who were feeling that we're not ready yet for this drilling to start because we're not prepared to be able to respond effectively to a spill, to be able to control the flow of the oil. So I think that there's still that is still a very strong concern on their part, that we don't know enough about the impacts on different marine mammals and fisheries and how, if you affect them, how it affects the indigenous way of life.
What about the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS? What is your organization's take on Arctic development? Do you have a position? Do you think it's a good idea?
CSIS itself is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. So the center itself is careful not to take positions, especially on politically sensitive issues like this. We feel like our job is to try to do some of the educational process to move forward. Researchers then can have positions, and I think that when, at least from my perspective, when we look at the needs we're going to have for oil supply in the future, if you look at the global context in which we live and the fact that oil production is going to be increasingly concentrated in a few countries, it becomes an important asset that needs to be developed. And I think that we do need to move forward making certain that we've got, you know, due attention to the potential risks.
David Pumphrey is the Deputy Director for the Center of Strategic and International Studies, Energy and National Security Program. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, is there a future for Pelican?
I guess we'd just have to expand a bit, because I've heard a lot of stories about the old days and, you know, how there used to be a bunch of people here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The state legislature could take another major step toward protecting personal privacy during next year's session as the House prepares to take up a Senate bill putting limits on the collection of what is called biometric identification data. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Biometrics are an individual's unique features, such as fingerprints, retinal images, facial maps, or voice qualities. There are places where such information is essential. Law enforcement or driver's licenses or building security, for example. But Anchorage Democrat Bill Wilikowski says the line is crossed when private businesses collect that information and sell it.
We didn't want to see Alaska become a surveillance state. We didn't want to see a situation where private organizations could set cameras and start monitoring people and detecting who's walking around on the street. It just felt that was a gross invasion of people's privacy.
Wilikowski says he has a proactive bill, basically preventing people or companies from gathering biometric data without the individual's expressed permission. He says it would also keep private the data gathered for legitimate use, preventing it from being sold or shared. Wilikowski's concerns are based on what is currently going on in Alaska. Jason Jaimo was one exam away from becoming a certified public accountant in Alaska. When he went to take the test in Anchorage, he was prepared with a driver's license and a passport. The company administering the test, however, wanted his fingerprints. They said for identification purposes.
And so I asked the lady, how is fingerprints ID if I've never been fingerprinted? You know, and why is a passport not sufficient identification again? I mean, there is no answer to that question, really. I didn't want to be treated like a criminal, and clearly a passport's adequate identification to travel the whole world, so why would it not be enough to sit down and take a test?
Jaimo, now a co-chairman of Citizens for Privacy in Alaska, never took the test. He says he later found that the fingerprints of people who did take the test were sold to a national company, and when he approached that company, he found that the data could be bought. Users of biometric information say the data is essential. State Farm Insurance, for example, opposed the bill in the Senate this year, saying it's a tool for control of secure information and access. Jaimo says that's overblown. There would have been no way of identifying him by his fingerprints, since he's never been fingerprinted before. The bill will be on the table for consideration, first by the House Health and Social Services Committee during next year's session. Committee Chair Wes Keller has already signed on as a co-sponsor of a similar bill introduced in the House. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A former Alaska lawmaker caught in a wide-ranging corruption probe has asked to have his retrial moved out of state. Attorneys for Vic Coring question whether he can get a fair trial given the publicity that his case and others like it have generated. In court papers filed late last week, they say there is more than an adequate foundation to presume prejudice and note what they call inflammatory pieces and commentary on Coring's case. They also say moving the trial to the lower 48 to another state within the Ninth Circuit will make it easier for witnesses to be called. The government has not yet responded to Coring's request. Earlier this year, an appeals court panel overturned Coring's conviction and ordered a retrial, citing prosecutorial errors. Sea Alaska land selection legislation will be before the U.S. House Natural Resources Committee tomorrow. The panel is the bill's final stop before heading to the House floor. The measure, authored by Alaska Congressman Don Young, is scheduled for markup. Young's office says it's expected to pass out of the committee with bipartisan support. The bill was introduced in April and had a hearing in May before the Indian Affairs Subcommittee. The office says only minor changes have been made since that hearing. Young's measure would designate Tongass National Forest timberlands that Sea Alaska could select and harvest. Most are on Prince of Wales Island. It also proposes economic development zones. The lands are outside boundaries set by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which created Native corporations. Sea Alaska says making additional selections within current boundaries and logging them could damage habitat and watersheds. Critics, including environmental groups, say the new selection areas include key habitat for fish and wildlife and should be protected. Senator Lisa Murkowski has her own version of the bill. It has significant differences, including some of the timberland locations. It also had a hearing in April. Her office says it hopes for a markup this summer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again is making the best decision for herself and her baby. The mother has a better chance of regaining health and energy between pregnancies, and her baby has a better chance of being born on time and at a good weight. Talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Southeast's commercial troll fleet finishes up their first Summer King salmon opening just before midnight tonight. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game expects trollers will reach the target harvest of nearly 102,000 Chinook salmon by the end of the day. The opening started July 1st. Trollers can head back out and fish for other salmon after offloading any kings caught in the opening. They'll have another king opening sometime in August after a closure designed to let coho salmon return to inside waters. Today, we conclude a three-part series on the Chichagof Island city of Pelican. In the first two parts, KCAW reported on the city's economic troubles, which center around the closure of its massive cold storage plant, and on how residents feel about some of the community's struggles. In this last of three reports, KCAW's Ed Ronco reports on the future of the city and those who see hope and promise in Lisianski Inlet.
Ice. Pelican was always known for having clean, quality ice, the kind fishermen need to keep their catch in good condition until the boat can get back to shore. But when the cold storage here closed, that went away. It could come back soon. The city received an $800,000 federal grant to buy two new ice machines. Whether those ice machines get installed depends on the success of negotiations to buy the cold storage property from its owners. Mayor Clint Bean says if that happens, he hopes the ice machines, at least, will be the start of some new industry in Pelican.
With the ice factor, we will have a bigger draw to the fishermen, and with more fishermen coming in, then we'll have more use of all the local facilities, businesses, you know, restaurants, etc. And that'll create more economy for Pelican itself.
And he says there are other things to help that happen. The city's broken water flume is under repair, which means jobs here for those repairing it. And once it's up and running, Pelican will return to hydropower. For going on 2 years, the city has generated electricity from diesel, which has pushed rates up to more than 50 cents per kilowatt hour. That's hardly a record among small Alaska communities, but it's steep compared to Sitka's 9 cents or Juneau's 12.
I won't give you a number, but it's safe to say that the hydro will lower the rates.
In addition to the cold storage purchase, the city also wants to buy the fuel dock. Both of them are owned by Cake Tribal Corporation. Some $300,000 for the fuel dock purchase was included in this year's capital budget. Those things, says Mayor Clint Bean, could help attract more people to this city. But he's also hoping to retain the ones who are here, especially young residents. That includes his son. Christopher Bean just completed his junior year of high school. He's sitting at a table inside the Lisianski Inlet Cafe, waiting for a mushroom cheeseburger. He moved up here 2 years ago from Metro Seattle and says after he graduates from high school, he wants to go to college someplace warm.
This year is the first year that I took a college course and got dual enrollment credits, so...
He wants to be mayor.
Yeah, I guess, sure.
You don't sound convinced.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Okay, so he doesn't want to be mayor, but he says he does want to come back here, at least in the summertime.
What would it take to get somebody your age to stay in a place like Pelican for a long time?
Oh, wow. More kids, for sure. More families. I guess we'd just have to expand a bit, because I've heard a lot of stories about the old days and, you know, how there used to be a bunch of people here. But when the cold storage was going and everything was working out, and now everything sort of hit bottom.
The old days, like, how long ago were the old days?
Oh, man. Like, 90s, probably. I don't know.
In 1990, Pelican's official population was 222. In the 2010 census, it was 88. While Christopher is the son of Pelican's current mayor, Frederick Phillips is the son of the city's most recent past mayor, Patty Phillips. Frederick Phillips is 25, a bit older than Christopher, and he remembers the old days in the 1990s. He says town looked a lot different back then.
Well, I remember as a kid, about 5 to 6 years old, there'd be the boardwalk would just be plumb full of people there in 10 o'clock or 10:30 break time. All the cold storage workers would come out.
He says he misses having all those people in town. But he also says he still likes living in Pelican.
Something keeps you here.
Yeah, something. Probably the mountains and the water.
Have you ever thought about going somewhere else, doing other things?
Oh, yeah. I just haven't done it yet.
Yet?
Yeah.
So someday, maybe.
Yeah, I'm kind of fishing, buying a permit, so I'm kind of stuck. It's not a bad place to be stuck, though.
While the future of Pelican rests, in part, on people like him, it also depends on new people coming in. People like Mike Chapman.
I had a construction company down south and just wanted to do something different. Had been here a few times visiting and decided, you know, couldn't think of a better place to live.
He calls himself semi-retired, came up here to do some commercial fishing, hand trolling, and now power trolling. And he's also on the city council.
It's a great community to live in. It's, you know, people here all care a lot about each other and... It's obvious with all the problems we've had the last, however you want to say, maybe even 10 years with the opening and closing of the cold storage, the community has survived and keeps moving along.
And back at City Hall, Mayor Bean hopes it will continue moving along. The public dollars he's hoping to score, including the state capital grant, will hopefully pave the way for more private investment from business along the boardwalk, he says. In the meantime, he hopes his residents keep their eye on the big picture.
You're always looking at the big picture. It's kind of the goal because everybody's faced with day-to-day issues, and they have to deal with those. The way to prevent it being surprised a bunch is to plan for your future. And I think Pelican's on the road to economic recovery and a good future.
Reporting from Pelican, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.